All right, we're back. I gave Richard the wrong phone number for my guest, so we're waiting to get him on the air. I have a David. Is that him? No, that's a ping. I can hear you, but I don't know if you got. We're actually calling you on the line that we prefer to use. So stand by, David, and pick that up if you can. And I'm going to have to get back to this topic for you guys. Here's another topic. Everyone in my office, and maybe throughout the whole community, got a letter from Homes.com trashing Zillow. Now, Zillow is a member of the MLS, so we can't trash local members, although they're not locally. And maybe trash is the wrong word. It's a pointed letter from Homes.com. Pointing out Zillow's, attempt to control the market and actually punishing people who don't specifically go to Zillow to advertise. They're banning people. And Homes.com is trying to point that out. Okay. Essentially, Zillow's trying to gain more market share. And they made good on their threats last week, banning agents' listings who hadn't submitted their listings to Zillow within 24 hours of marketing it. Now, there's a rule that if you start marketing a house, you have to submit it to MLS. That's our rules. But now Zillow is demanding that you submit to them directly. So even though it might be listed in the Santa Barbara MLS, following MLS and NAR rules, when a buyer searches for that property on Zillow, they see it falsely labeled as off-market. So Zillow has long misled buyers about the real estate agent, who the real agent is. That's another thing with Zillow. You go click on it, and they send you to people who are paying Zillow to get leads. And you might think, well, what do I care? Well, you might not care. But you might want to talk direct to the listing agent. You might be an agent. I've been online with Zillow trying to get through. Well, a little bit of a delay in getting David Dearson from the Pacific Legal Foundation on the air. I apologize, David. I'm a little dyslexic. Gave him the wrong number. Gave him 916 instead of 919 area code. Sorry about that. David Dearson is an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation focusing on private property rights. He joined PLF in 2018, been involved in multiple high-profile cases, most notably served as a member of the litigation team Tyler versus Hennepin County. U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled that home equity theft violates the Fifth Amendment Takings Clause. Well, why are you involved in another home equity theft case, David? It's gone through the Supreme Court, and now you're dealing with another one. Let's see if I have the name in front of me. Lynette Johnson, an immigrant in New Jersey.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, when the Supreme Court issues a ruling about the Constitution, that's not necessarily the end of the story. Because first of all, the states actually need to rewrite their statutes, the previous versions of which offended the Constitution. So states need to rewrite their tax foreclosure statutes. New Jersey has done so, but it left a couple of loopholes in. In this case, actually predated Tyler. We filed it before the Tyler case was decided. And the government, which in this case is the city of East Orange, Jersey, is doing everything it can to try to avoid paying back Ms. Johnson what they took from her. We won the case in the New Jersey Court of Appeals, but the city is now seeking review from the Supreme Court of New Jersey.
So people understand this, first of all, the difference between her property selling price, $101,000, how the heck can you buy anything in New Jersey for $101,000? I assume the market value was even less than the $101,000. And her tax debt was $24,000, which is amazing. And you would think the government entity would take their $24,000 plus some maybe interest and penalties, and then give the rest of the money back to the owner, but that's not their policy. First of all, how does someone get $24,000 behind on their taxes?
Well, you know, the $24,000 includes interest, and in New Jersey, tax lien certificates are often purchased at the maximum interest rate of 18%. Plus, they tack on all kinds of other fees and expenses, including attorney's fees for the prosecution of the foreclosure. Now, some of that stuff is fair enough, and some of it's probably excessive, but what you're absolutely right about is they certainly don't have any claim to a dime of it more than what she actually owed. But you're right, it has been their policy to take everything, including all the equity. Now, we know that's unconstitutional, but the government says, hey, we didn't know it was unconstitutional, and so you shouldn't make us pay for it. Maybe we'll pay for it going forward, but on a case like this, which is older than Tyler, we shouldn't have to pay this one because we didn't know it was unconstitutional.
Boy, so when I get pulled over for speeding and I tell the cop, well, I didn't know the speed limit was X, but now that I know going forward, you can't give me a ticket because I wasn't aware of it. That seems like is the word specious argument?
Yeah. Absolutely. And we'll see how the Supreme Court of New Jersey deals with it, but I'm confident that it won't go much differently than the speeding ticket. Of course, the court doesn't have to accept review, and it may not. It may just decide that the appellate division's decision was correct, and the appellate court in New Jersey said, of course you have to pay. You stole the money from her.
Oh, they did?
So they did, yeah. We
so
won
the,
at the
so, so it's the government division. Entity that's taking it to the Supreme Court.
That's right.
God, it's not as if she's trying to get the house back and they already sold it to someone and they can't unring that bell, okay? I could maybe understand that. But it's just a matter of it's money in the budget. I wonder what she actually owed. I guess was this the case where she had moved and they were sending the invoices to somebody else? And how long? I mean, you know, I feel sorry for the woman, but you also got to figure you got to pay taxes twice a year. How could she not know that she didn't pay her taxes? But I don't want to blame the victim.
Well, no, that's certainly a fair question. The issue is it was a commercial property, and when she bought it, it was in disrepair. So she bought it with the plans to renovate it. Actually, she signed a letter of agreement with the city about those plans to renovate. And one of the things that the city made her agree to was not to occupy the property in any way until the renovation was complete. Now, meanwhile, they're sending notices of the tax assessment, not to her residential address that they have on file. They're sending all the notices to the property itself, but the property doesn't have a mailbox because they told her not to occupy the property in any way till the renovations were complete. So she never got any of the notices of the tax assessment. She never got notice that the home was facing, that the property was facing foreclosure, because they never sent any mailing to the address she lived at, even though they had that address on file.
How long did she not pay taxes? A couple of years?
It was the first tax assessment that she didn't receive, so it went into foreclosure basically immediately.
What a bizarre story. I hate those stories. Well, hopefully you'll go, and succeed on that. Ironically, I didn't intend to start with that one because you had two cases, and I wanted to start with the other one. It's right here in California, Palo Alto, Wesley Yu versus City of East Palo Alto. My guest, David Dearson from the Pacific Legal Foundation. I think it's pacificlegal.org. They champion private property rights, represent people for free. They take donations. I think I've told you I first met them back around 1999, 2000, because Marilyn Senegals, who was a regular radio real estate listener for years, told me about you guys. And when she passed away, she left you a sizable donation in her will. So, shout out to Marilyn Senegals.
Absolutely.
So, this is this Wesley Yu versus City of East Palo Alto, California. and it's about inclusionary housing. And what are these people trying to do, and what are they protesting?
Yeah, that's right. So what's at issue here is what's often called an inclusionary zoning or inclusionary housing policy, which kind of sounds nice the way they say it, but the name is a little misleading. Really, the idea is that if you want to build residential housing in the city of East Palo Alto, they're not going to let you do it unless you pay massive fees to subsidize housing elsewhere in the city. Now, that kind of thing is unconstitutional, because governments aren't allowed to charge impact fees on development unless those impact fees mitigate some actual negative impact of the development. And if you take a second to think about it, when you build residential development, you're not making housing affordability problems worse. You're making them better because you're adding supply. But not only is it unconstitutional, for the same reason, it's also bad policy, because it tries to do the illogical thing of making housing more affordable by making it more costly. So in Wesley Yu's case, he wants to build a single family home with an ADU for his family. They're telling him that they're only going to let him build it if he pays about $55,000 in affordable housing fees, or if he doesn't want to pay, he can rent out the new house to a stranger at below market rates in perpetuity. Of course, that's not good. He doesn't want to rent out the house at all. He wants to live there.
Apparently, they're living next door in a 1,000-square-foot house. He owns two parcels adjacent, and so he wants to build this a little larger house. Not that it's relevant, but I just wonder what it costs to build a house in an ADU. I don't know how many square feet he's building. It's really irrelevant, but I'm just kind of curious to know what percentage the fee of the in-lieu fee of $54,000, almost $55,000 is.
You know, it's a good question. I don't know exactly what the total construction cost he's looking at is, but I do know for certain that the $55,000 fees is potentially cost prohibitive and may make it not make sense in the first place. But as you said, the home they're living in now is very small, less than 1,000 square feet. The couple has a child, and their in-laws come to visit all the time, and they just don't have enough space. So in the short term, they're looking to add some extra space to accommodate their family. And of course, in the long term, they're creating new residential units that are going to last, 100 years or more, that the city of East Palo Alto is going to be able to take advantage of. But for some reason, the city wants to make it harder for them to build.
My guest, David Dearson, Pacific Legal Foundation, pacificlegal.org. You mentioned certain city fees. If you're building something and perhaps the city needs to cut in a driveway in the curb, or they need to do mitigation for traffic, they may have to put in a stop sign, or they may have to put in a traffic light if you're building 100 units or something. It's hard to believe that building one single family home is going to really impact, and the city's going to have to charge you to do something. But you were reasonable to say that that's something that's legitimate.
Yeah, exactly. The city can charge fees or impose conditions that have to do with the actual impacts of the property. So I think one easy example, there oftentimes you'll see stormwater management fees or easements. And that probably makes sense in most cases, because you're adding impervious area to the surface of the lot. And so you're actually making flooding problems worse, and so it's reasonable to make the developer bear the expense of the problem that they're creating. But the rule is, it has to be, if they're going to charge a fee or if they're going to take some property from you as a condition of a development permit, it has to be related in both kind and magnitude to the impacts of your development. So in other words, just because stormwater management fees, for example, are in principle reasonable, they still have to be proportionate in magnitude to your actual impact. When it comes to these affordable housing fees, we think they're basically categorically unconstitutional, because as a matter of, the law of economics, new supply lowers prices. It doesn't raise prices. So there's really no good argument that new residential development is going to create an affordability problem that they can make you mitigate with fees. Really, it's just a tool to extort people who desperately need the government's approval for their permit and just, you know, milk as much money out of them as they can.
Do you think your argument against this city's inclusionary housing ordinance, is that a different case where the city, for example, tells the developer, okay, if you're going to build 12 units or X number of units over, I don't know what the minimum is, you have to include one or two or three affordable housing units. Is that, would you call that inclusionary housing? And is that something that you have fought against, or is it a different animal?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really the same policy idea. And most of these policies that you see in California or elsewhere will have options. So they'll say either you can pay the fee or you can set aside some percentage of units market rate.
Well, hold on a second. So when you said yes, you're saying it's a similar thing and it's something that you fought against?
Yes, we have. Now, there's a Supreme Court case from the State Supreme Court, California State Supreme Court, from about 2015 that actually approved of that kind of policy that said the rule that I'm describing doesn't apply when it's just a matter of price controlling units. Now, we think that that ruling is wrong and that there's a good chance it can be overturned at the federal level. But this case is a little different because, like I said before, you know, they're just building one unit and they don't plan to rent it at all. So it's not a matter of just, you know, regulating landlord-tenant relationships or regulating the sale of real property. It's essentially forcing them to have an unwanted tenant in a home that they otherwise plan to occupy themselves or else pay the fee. So it's a little bit different from that California Supreme Court case.
Very good. Very good. And so how much time do you think this will take before you can get this heard? What in the meantime, they can't build.
Yeah, that's right. And we're in the federal district court in Northern California, filed our complaint a few weeks ago. You know, these things take some time. We'll see how the city responds. We haven't gotten either an answer to the complaint yet or a motion to dismiss. But we'll see what they say.
You know, a lot of people, they don't have the time and effort to fight it. And if they have the money, they just pay it. So it's good that people like this come up and try to put it to the test. It does seem unreasonable. Seems like a staggering amount. I've been talking recently about price per square foot, and I'm sure they're not building, you know, a 5,000 square foot house. I'm sure it's going to be something more modest, and they already own the land. So I don't know if they're going to spend $500,000, and this represents 10%. It's a huge amount of money. Well, we'll wish you luck with that.
Yeah, it is. And I just want to add, you know, you said, you know, if they do have the money, they probably don't have the wherewithal to fight back and they'll just pay it. I think sometimes that's true, but I would add, you know, the other option is things don't get built. And, you know, that may or may not be the case for a single family, family built project like this one, but certainly there's a lot of empirical data out there that these kind of policies actually reduce development, because if the project just doesn't make sense economically, then the developers don't build. And so in that way, it's still, you know, not making housing more affordable. It's making it less affordable by reducing supply.
I hear you, and I wish you luck on this case. Sorry for the little mishap getting you on the air originally, but we managed to get an update on both cases. David Dearson, Pacific Legal Foundation, pacificlegal.org. Any last second comment that, or did we cover everything?
Well, we mostly did. I'll just say, you know, these inclusionary zoning policies are a major litigation target for us because a recent Supreme Court victory last year in Sheets versus County of El Dorado that PLF was involved in has now put them on the table for challenge. And so we're filing these cases all over. This is the second such case we filed in California within the last year. We've also got similar cases in Denver, Colorado, in Teton County, Wyoming. And you can expect them to keep coming because we think this is a good candidate for a Supreme Court review.
Well, I love to see you be successful. David Dearson, back in college, you co-founded the Vanderbilt Immigration Law Group. And is it true you're the only member that is yet to be deported?
Yeah, it seems that way sometimes.
Hey, I'm going to give you a quick law firm joke. Law firm of Smith, 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 and Smith. Man calls up, says, "I'd like to speak to Mr. Smith." Person answers, says, "I'm sorry, Mr. Smith is on vacation." The guy says, "All right, I'd like to speak to Mr. Smith." And he goes, "I'm sorry, he's in conference." "Well, okay, can I speak to Mr. Smith?" "I'm sorry, he's out sick today." And finally he says, "Well, can I speak to Mr. Smith?" And he says, "Speaking."
Right.
David Dearson, Pacific Legal Foundation, pacificlegal.org. Thanks for joining Radio Real Estate.
Thanks very much. Always
okay,
a pleasure.
We'll talk to you again. Thanks. Bye. Are you listening to Mark Schneidman's Radio Real Estate, RadioRealEstate.com. We'll take a quick break. I'll finish the letter that agents have received from Homes.com questioning Zillow's tactics. And stay tuned. You'll be right back.